From the Sky News Centre at 6, the world of sport's been paying tribute to Andy Murray after he announced he's retiring. Daisy Gray reports.
Been struggling for a long time. I've been in a lot of pain.
Murray's hoping for one last appearance at Wimbledon, but his body may not allow him to make it. Fellow pros like Kyle Edmund and Johanna Konta are gutted.
He's been my biggest role model. He's Britain's greatest tennis player ever.
Just can't imagine the sport without him, to be honest.
Britain's Dan Evans won the Davis Cup playing alongside Murray in 2015.
It's just very sad news for tennis and especially British tennis. He helped everyone a lot.
The three-time Grand Slam winner says he's very touched by the support he's received.
A British couple have been injured after a bus carrying tourists and locals crashed in eastern Cuba. 7 people have died and 5 are in a critical condition. There are calls for the government to go further in its new reforms of universal credit. The Work and Pension Secretary has announced she's scrapping the plan to extend the 2-child benefits cap. It says 4 working single mums have won a High Court challenge over the scheme and the way payments are calculated. Disabled single mother Tutu Marley says the changes don't go far enough.
I would have liked that there'd be an announcement of getting 100% back with regards to lower income families through the provision. I also would have liked to have heard what they're able to do to help working mothers such as myself bridge that gap to be able to return to work.
Teachers in England miss more than 50,000 days a week due to illness. The National Education Union says supply agencies exploit large schools by charging big fees for cover. Tesco and Marks and Spencer have revealed they're stockpiling food to prepare for a no-deal Brexit. It's less than 80 days until the UK is due to leave the EU. And in sport, Chelsea boss Maurizio Sarri believes Bayern Munich have been disrespectful in their pursuit of Callum Hudson-Odoi. The teenagers had 4 bids from the German club in this transfer window. That's the latest. I'm Laura Safe.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news as Labour councillor for Brislington East, Mike Langley. Martin Summers is having a few weeks off, so we'll be joined after the 7 o'clock news by the author of Earth into Property, Professor Anthony Hall from Canada. And of course, Bristol was involved quite a lot in colonising that part of the world. 1497 even. That was John Cabot went over there, and Anthony's written a book, and it's called "The Colonisation and Decolonisation and Capitalism in America." So picking up where Coulson left off. After the 7 o'clock news as well, distraction politics, the trumped-up wall. Although the evidence is it would make little difference, it's become Trump's touchstone policy. Donald Trump was elected to build it. But are the Republicans actually for minimal government? Is the shutdown just a sneaky way to bring in Republican policies that would otherwise be impossible to get away with? Part of a wider agenda, both sides of the Atlantic and beyond, to shut down and bankrupt democratic governments and to hand us over to the oligarchy, the bank ruled by the banksters and big business. And whatever happened to the Minsk agreement? Fake news on the BBC. Jonah Fisher reports on the World Service that Russia and Ukraine are at war. They're not, of course. It's just fake news on the BBC by a BBC reporter. What does he base this theory on? And what happens when he's questioned about this so-called war between Russia and Ukraine? And the Israel lobby, former New Yorker and international relations academic Ron Mandel, is a new arrival in Bristol. We talked to him about the hidden Israeli influence on media and politics, both sides of the Atlantic, along with Professor Anthony Hall. That's in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 degrees and dry this weekend, highs around 11, cloudy and breezy, but should be free of rain. Next week, highs around 10 Celsius, some sunny spells and some fleeting showers. Next weekend, 19th and 20th of January, highs of 7 Celsius, sunshine and light showers next weekend. So if you want to get out and about, do it this weekend. You won't get rained on, hopefully. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Brislington East, Mike Langley. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you.
First of all, Mike, actually, just looking at the weather there, we don't normally do this, but it's been quite mild, hasn't it? I mean, hardly any temperatures really below freezing this winter. What do you think this is, just indicative of the whole global warming or climate change business? What's going on?
I think we've tipped over. I think it's irreversible. But I'm a vegetarian and vegan, and people go on about coal and emissions from cars, but apparently, I don't know if it's true or not, but I read it somewhere, but apparently one of the main causes of C2O gases is beef and cows. So I think for to save the planet, we all got to go vegan and vegetarianism.
Well, one of the facts of the matter is that the amount of land that's used to rear cattle and sheep, livestock generally, I mean, this is absolutely beyond dispute. You're not getting anywhere near as many bangs for your bucks in terms of protein as you would if you were growing pulses and beans and things like that. How long ago did you turn vegan, vegetarian, and how? You know, and do you still miss the bacon sandwich, that sort of thing?
I'd say no, but I people would dispute that. I used to work just across the road when in a former life. I was a shop steward over for First Bristol, and I worked full time for the last 15 years, full time in the union office. And when I used to walk in the canteen first thing in the morning and they'd be preparing a bacon, and I must admit, the smell of fresh.
So when did you become, when did you decide and why?
Where did I say? Well, no. I hope my ex-wife, one of my ex-wives, I hope she's not listening, because I met her and she was a vegetarian, and basically to get a girl, I had to give up meat. So,
and you that weren't was allowed to cook meat in the house or anything like that. No.
See,
and so, what made you? Okay, so that's one obvious reason. But what about the veganism? That's because that's another step, isn't it? Giving up milk, eggs, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I have tried that, and I can't do it. I have tried soya milk and coconut milk, and I just can't get on with it. And I got a son who's an head chef out of Uwe, and every now and again he'll buy me a big slab of Stilton. And sorry, I
so
can't
you're actually a veggie. You're not a vegan.
No, I can't make that final step.
So you talking about working at First? You worked there a long time. And how far back do you go with the buses here in Bristol?
To 1969, I was on a bus for 44 years. I was at Staple Hill, and then when they closed that, I moved to Muller Road, and then when I got a full-time union position, I came down here to Lawrence Hill.
And so what were you actually, did you make the transition from working on the buses to then starting to work in the union, or did you come straight into the union?
Obviously it was unionised when we had it. It was a closed stop, and with the terms and conditions and the way that First and Bristol Omnibus staff relations, even still now we got over 99% trade union and membership, and I was a shop steward, and then a vacancy came for and I put in for this full-time unit.
So
I
was a shop steward. You've been voted that by the members, by other workers, you're still a worker yourself.
I was, but then I took up a full-time union position, but I was still paid for by First.
What were you doing on the buses then, conducting, driving, or what?
I started off as a conductor for 3 months, and I got laid off. I worked on the builders, and I got laid off in the heavy winter in 68, 69, and I went on a conductor, and I thought, only temporary, like November, back out on the buildings in the following spring. Anyway, then they offered me down the driving school, and you had to sign a form, you'd stayed there for 2 years. 2 years at 21, you think, that's no time, isn't it? Anyway, 44 years later, I was still there.
So who was actually running the buses in those days?
Bristol Line Buses. It was Bristol Joint Services. The council owned 49%, and Bristol Line Bus, as was then, owned 51%.
Okay, so they had a majority share. But yeah, who were they? Were they just like some local investors?
No, it was Tellins. It was a major bus company which was nationalised by Wilson and become National Bus Company, which then became Bristol, part of National Bus Company, and then Thatcher flogged it all off in 89.
Well, it might sound like a fatuous question, but were you actually driving Bristol buses, you know, Bristol made buses or not?
Yes. We it wasn't until the 80s that it started becoming Leylands and then Volvos and like they got now, because Bristol Commercial Vehicles was still open and when I started up Staple Hill, we still had the open back with conductors on the back. And we had the 18s up Staple Hill, which was it went up the Clifton, so that was and the council then could say which buses went on, which were on one route, and when they started bringing in the buses with the doors, they insisted they went on the Clifton route because it was considered a better area.
Oh, I see.
We did the 4s and 4As up Staple Hill, and they went up the Knowle, and Knowle in them days, rightly or wrongly, and same as Ilfield and parts of Southmead, was considered a bit rough areas, right?
So what have you seen in the big changes in those years? Because now we hear a lot of complaints about buses. One of the main complaints is that they don't serve poor areas very much anymore. They keep withdrawing routes that go to poor areas. The other is the obvious, I suppose, that the fares keep going up. In fact, we had last year, I think it was around about October, when Marvin made his State of the City speech, that the Labour mayor, was almost applauding the first group's change to have a flat fare. But the fact is that actually the rider tickets, which most people use, which allows you to, you know, you use to go there and back, it's like a return really, but also you can use it on other buses too, that fare went up. So actually overall it looks as if even that, which was supposed to be good according to the mayor, it looks like an increased fare as well. And I don't want to pile too much on you, but there's another thing, and that is the franchising, because Tim Bowles, who's the Metro Mayor, he doesn't seem to want to come on this programme. I've been emailing him on and off. I've had various letters back. At some point, I will read those letters out from the Mayor's office saying, oh, we thought you didn't want him to come on because he didn't reply to your email and you said so on air. Obviously, they're listening, which is nice to know that they're listening to the show. But then because we said it doesn't look like he wants to come on, we're still waiting for a reply because I said that on the air. They then said, oh, well, we took that to mean you didn't want to see him. So actually, of course, if you're listening, please, Tim Bowles, it would be lovely to have you on the radio here to talk about franchising, because it's something that most people in the city want. The democratically elected council to be able to make decisions about which buses go where rather than just the route itself. Anyway, I'll shut up. Over to you. What do you make of this modern system?
Thatcher privatised and denationalised us, and obviously the main cost to a bus apron was the terms and conditions of the workforce. When I was on a union and we had a 37-hour a week, now, because I'm still in contact with the union office, now they've gone back up to a 44-hour a week. We were doing that in the late 60s and we got it down to 37 hours. We had a three-tier pension scheme. We had a platinum, gold and a bronze, and it was a final salary scheme. I was fortunate enough to be in a final salary scheme, and I retired on a final salary in platinum, so I was one of the lucky ones.
Now, just for those that don't know, the final salary scheme, that it gives you a pension which is equivalent to your salary at the end of retire.
And it was, and
that's a fantastic scheme.
Yeah, and it was. And for every pound, I meant to turn it off. And for every pound I put in, the company put £1.50 in. It was a brilliant scheme. Now the only option to everybody is the bronze scheme, which is worse. Their conditions is worsened, And it's a private company.
Well, what about people who are complaining about the first group closing lines, though, Mike?
Yes, it's a private company. It was a public service. It's a private company now. Well,
some people have said that first group was set up. I mean, originally set up, it was shareholder owned and managed.
Yes, but like, well, it was like when they flogged off the council houses.
So you had some shares in it, did you?
No, I did not. No. And I think this is one of the reasons I have a number of ex-wives. My socialist principles at the time, and as a union, and we took a lot of stick over the years, but at the time, we told people not to touch these shares. These shares was offered to staff for 7 pence a time. 3 months later, they was changing hands at £6.
Right, so that is 100 times more. Yeah. So that's basically, if you've got £1,000 you invest in shares, almost in a few weeks after that, that's £100,000 you've got. That's £99,000 nothing.
There was a lot of managers, and there was a lot of managers, and that made a fortune. But it's how capitalism works. And the rules stated at the time that you couldn't buy a company within 50 miles, I think it was. It might have been less than that. But anyway, so I don't say it was a scam because it was obviously legal, otherwise they wouldn't go on it. But Badgerline bought Midland Red. Midland Red then bought, as we were then, Bristol Omnibus. And they metamorphosed into Badgerline, in which subsequently was taken over by Grampian, who become this massive conglomerate.
So where did City Line, I can just about remember that, where did that fit into?
Oh, that was just a brand name on the buses. When they brought in the minibuses, I can't remember, if you can remember them, the mini darts and all the rest of it, that was only the smash terms and conditions of the workforce, because they come in on a lower rates and what have you. And the other thing was, same thing happened with council housing. I've always lived in council housing. I was brought up in council housing. I lived in council housing. I was lucky enough to get a council house, and then Thatcher come along, and she was offering council tenants, if you've been in a council house, and she come with a right to buy scheme and offered 70% discount. And that was another nail in my coffin to my marriage. I refused to buy my council house on my principles. And I could have bought that council house, because we lived in Oldbury Court at the time, I could have bought that council house for a couple of grand. And you've got council house, ex-council houses now in Oldbury Court going for 190,000-odd. I mean, there's no wonder there's people can't afford houses, and you've got a housing shortage. I blame, obviously, we haven't built enough. Well, the council weren't allowed to. We haven't built enough houses, but I think part of all this housing crisis stems back to the right to buy.
Just to bring to this week's news in for a second as well, we've just heard this week that the government needs to build 3 million social homes if they want to solve the housing crisis. A landmark review has shown. I'll put links to that in our show page at thisweek.org.uk. That's the particular article is in The Independent. Is there any chance that you think under this government they'll get 3 million social homes built, Mike?
Not at all.
Because that really means housing associations and councils, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. And in fairness to Marvin and Paul Smith, they are building council houses for the first time for many years. The number of council housing is going up, and this is why Paul is meeting such opposition from developers, because he's insisting, he's insisting that so many units are social housing.
What do you make of what's going on here in the city? Because, you know, we're not going to be going anywhere near meeting our needs. The council housing waiting list is something between 15,000 and 20,000 homeless people. Now, that doesn't mean to say you're on the street necessarily, although many are. It means you're either in some sort of temporary hostel accommodation, bed and breakfast, you're sleeping on a friend's sofa, you're round at someone's spare room, if they're allowed to have one, if they haven't had the bedroom tax to take it off of them. How are we going to sort that out here in Bristol, Mike?
Until we get a socialist government led by Jeremy Corbyn, which hopefully we will get this year, because the way May and the Tories exploding over this Brexit nonsense, the only way forward, I truly believe, then we're getting a proper housing programme.
So it's not going to happen under Conservatives, no?
No, no way.
Well, one thing's for sure, it's not just here in Britain. Over in Holland too, there has been quite a big clampdown on people who are living, for example, on squatted land, yeah, living for nothing. And this is people, many of whom over the years have been evicted and they found nowhere to live. And so they basically got together with others and they're living in squats. And I can announce that today a building was taken by Bristol squatters, and that is in solidarity with this eviction over in Amsterdam. Now, the place in Amsterdam is called the ADM. I'm not sure exactly what it stands for. We're probably about to hear that from a chap I interviewed on Wednesday who's involved in this squat in Bristol this week. And he was over at the ADM squat before it was evicted over, spent Christmas over there. About 120 people live there. Beautiful place on the docks in Amsterdam, which was evicted this week. So let's have a listen to Alan Shane now.
They've been going for so long. There's thousands of people around the world who have been affected directly through performing there, developing their arts there. So let me just explain a little bit how the ADM was like. When you went there, there was a continual kitchen operating. It was generally vegan, vegetarian food. They would grow a lot of the food themselves. Basically, the terrain had developed over 21 years into something of a nature reserve, where a forest grew up through the concrete, you know. Most of their focus was on living sustainably, on working together as a community, on helping each other out. You know, there was lots of workshops there, workshop spaces there, obviously cafes, concerts, art shows, free shop, you know, you name it. It was a model of how a sort of people can live and work together quite successfully without intervention from the municipality. You know, just self-organisation. They would organise themselves through meetings, you know. And it was a really beautiful atmosphere, you know. And
well, how does all this relate to Bristol?
How it relates to Bristol is that the spaces in Bristol, the free autonomous spaces, like I know at the moment there's a campaign about the bear pit to have it safe. And as well, just generally, the cultural life of the city relies on these autonomous zones, autonomous spaces, spaces that aren't based on the economic model, that allow people to bring in new ideas, that allow people to create things that aren't reliant on funding, that aren't reliant on being able to sell it.
Well, one of the great things about these autonomous spaces, as you call them, is that you can function on there without the overheads that most people need, well, most businesses need. And that, Alan, this is all taking place at a time when a lot of people are looking at the economy and saying, well, look, it's going down. We surely need to have some sort of alternative. You're being pushed. The people in Amsterdam are being pushed into an economy which is failing.
Exactly. I mean, you can see it on both on a housing model, because it's not just okay, squatters, that's been made illegal, but it's more than necessary as ever. You can also talk about the boat, people that live in boats. That's being suppressed as well. Now it's been more and more difficult, and people are having to move further and further in their boats. Horse-drawn travelling people, they're now bringing in legislation where if you tie your horse outside the shop and go into the shop, they come around and people have had their horses stolen and their livelihoods taken away. I mean, the council had won the court case 6 months before, and were pushing to, as quickly as they could, evict these people and destroy their life as well, lifestyles. But the UN did step in, and we were there on Christmas Day, and it was very hopeful, sad. But then on Boxing Day, the UN turned around and said, this is, and they wrote a writ saying this is against the UN's Committee on Human Rights, and we are asking, they asked the Amsterdam City Council twice to stop the eviction. They gave them more time, at least 2 months, so that they could organise and, you know, have a little bit of leeway. And the Amsterdam Council pushed forward the eviction before a final court case that was to try and implement this UN's decision could be reached.
So do you think we're going to see
all autonomous spaces phased out?
Well, they've tried. They tried in the 80s, in the famous Battle of the Beanfield, to suppress the culture of free travel and freedom of movement and free parties and the free festivals and all that. They tried that, but there's more people than ever living that lifestyle. So I don't see how it can't be phased out, because it's a necessary. It's very sad because it's necessary for the city. I mean, ultimately, these subcultures that need to survive and thrive need these autonomous zones. They are what feeds back into the mainstream culture. And ultimately, where the mainstream culture grows and develops and takes its nourishment from. And that's been going on since time immemorial. You know, this is not a new recent thing, these few squatters. This is something that's, you know, highly, highly significant to Bristol and all major cities in Europe.
Well, that's Alan Shane there speaking to me earlier this week. He's one of the people who's taken over this place in the Bristol city centre, apparently owned by the council, Mike. It is the ADM Solidarity Squat at 39 High Street. That is just by St Nick's Market, opposite Castle Park, next to the old Rummer pub. And at 2 o'clock, apparently tomorrow, there's going to be some sort of protest there about homelessness and about autonomous spaces. Basically, the council should be, they say, giving spaces over for travellers and people like that, which are closer to the city centre. I mean, many of them, they get told, well, if you want to live in a caravan or something, you're going to have to go to Avonmouth. And of course, many of them have got jobs in the city. Avonmouth is way over the horizon, Mike.
Yeah, you're right. And it needs to, yeah, a lot more needs to be done. Bristol's got a terrible housing and a homeless problem, yeah. And I agree, squatters, people will object. But if you're homeless and you're desperate, people, they got to be, yeah, it's not saying encouraged, but it's got to be accepted and it's got to be...
But it's like a safety valve.
Yeah,
that's the way
I
see it.
One of the saddest things, I've been a councillor this time since 2010, but I was a councillor before in the 90s. And the saddest thing, I must admit, was last year it was proposed that an empty council building, St Anne's House, down in St Anne's, along by the river, would be a temporary homeless shelter for this winter, and if the funding was secured for next winter as well. The amount of opposition, and it was. I know people don't. It's perceived, but the amount of opposition, it was, and some of it was terrible. There was tales that every druggie, every homeless person was going to get buses and all the rest of it, and they was going to descend en masse on St Anne's. Jesus Christ, if you live in St Anne's, you can't get a bus. The 36 don't ever turn up. So I don't know how these people, but anyway. And the people that are in there, they've got about 40 in there. They're selected, and it's those that are making the first steps, whatever problems they had, to be integrated back into society. That got to be the way forward. We can't demonise because somebody's homeless.
I think the thing is, well, if you're not in a caravan, you're going to be on the street, aren't you?
Yeah.
So this is why we've got this explosion in people living in caravans.
With the rollout of this cruel universal credit, people, if you're in that situation, I bet most people's just a few weeks away from. Because if you ain't going to get your money paid for a rent, and you've got a landlord that wants his money, you are facing it. I got a daughter. She was made homeless, and she was put in temporary accommodation a few weeks before Christmas last year, and she'd been in temporary accommodation for a 12-month. And she's a lucky one. She's been given a house. But there's thousands of people in Bristol in temporary accommodation, families. What, we expect people, mothers and kids, out on the streets? No, it's as a site, I despair. So I do, truly.
Well, there's not everyone despairs. Truly. Sometimes people find ways around this and find ways of making a bit of money. And actually, there's been a brilliant drama on it started last Wednesday evening on ITV. I don't know if you saw it, Mike. It's called Cleaning Up. And it's, I would recommend it to people. Have a look at 9 o'clock next Wednesday. It's episode one was last week on ITV. The struggling mum Sam discovers access to lucrative stock market information whilst working as a cleaner at Canary Wharf. Is this the answer to her spiralling debts? So what she's doing is she's spying. She's put a little microphone and she's spying on some of the bankers so that she's getting tips where to put her money in which shares, because she's saying effectively, and what this drama is saying, is that it's one law for them and another law for everyone else.
I'm the wrong person to ask about television. I haven't had a television, and my daughters all think I'm mad and various. I haven't had a television for 20 some odd years. I will not watch television because I think, and I will not have Sky in the house. I do not. I won't buy Murdoch's papers. I certainly don't want any of his nonsense beamed into my living room.
Murdoch doesn't own Sky anymore. He's just sold it. And that's one of the reasons I used to say the Murdoch news we were going to have, because it was the Sky radio news. Now it's actually an American, which is maybe even worse, is it's owned by an American company. So we've got the Americans deciding who our editors of the news in here in BCFM and all over the country for Sky are going to be. And it's a company called Comcast. And I think there's also Disney have got some sort of a say in it as well. So maybe we're getting the Mickey Mouse news.
Yeah.
So you might not be missing too much.
Yeah, missing. I'm a great supporter I read a lot, and I'm a great supporter of the libraries and further the library campaign that kept all 27 of them open. And that and the radio, because I listen to local radio and I listen to I'm in a situation where I've got an ex-wife staying with me temporarily, and she holds similar socialist views, and she won't have the BBC news on at all.
Well, that's funny, isn't it? Because the BBC is supposed to be state-run; it's supposed to be a socialist institution.
No. I find the BBC news Question Time. Apparently she used to watch Question Time, and she says her and a lot of her friends will no longer watch Question Time because of all the Tory plants in the audience.
Well, it's not just that; it's also the panels they have a very limited scope of views on the panels. Last night was the first on BBC Question Time of Fiona Bruce taking over from David Dimbleby. So I watched that. We call it Borrow Time at home. But we watch it anyway, religiously. And I thought it was really incredibly limp, Mike. So you're not missing too much. Well, they only managed to answer about two questions. There was one on Brexit, and then there was one on stabbings in London. And she was very Fiona Bruce, bless her. I'm sure she's very good at reading an auto cue on the news, but when it comes to actually taking command of the national debate, it was very, very limp. And she was making interventions that you were rolling your eyes around, thinking, "Why is she saying that?" You know. So she's just not up to the job. What you need is someone who's been a respected, seasoned journalist reporter for a long time. It doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman; that's not an issue. But someone who's done the job for a long time probably should be doing that. We'll just move on to talk about some other local stuff here. The Bristol Energy. Now, this has been a bit of a disaster, hasn't it? I know it wasn't set up under Marvin, but apparently now it's going to cost something like £22 million if the City Council pulls out. Have you, do you think, as a council, been able to cope with what's happened there? Because I think it's £11 million in debt now. And this is our money that's been spent on this.
Yeah, but apparently there's plans to, I don't think I'm talking out of turn, but there's plans to re-energise it and expand it, because apparently you don't make money on gas and electric, you make the money on services, like British Gas.
Is gone, isn't it better just to pull out? It's like, and they say in the military, never reinforce a failure. And 11 million is quite a failure. It's like a noose around Marvin's neck. I can see this. It's a really difficult one for him to deal with. But do you think he's going to manage it?
Yeah. I'm sure if it is re-energised and expanded, hopefully the long term plan is that it will start picking up and start paying back. But how long do you wait for? I can see with all the council restraints on services. Yeah, it must look rather like Bristol did in the 80s and 90s when we was funding the Bristol docks. and that was millions, yeah. And that was Bristol sinking.
Yeah, is it actually cheaper, Bristol Energy? If you go on to Bristol Energy, can you get cheaper cheaper electricity, gas, repairs around your house? What are you getting for your money?
I don't know about repairs. I think that's what they're expanding to looking, because that's where the big money's made. But the actual cost of, is apparently on a year. If you go with Bristol Energy, you're saving yourself about £200 a year.
Well, okay, so fingers crossed that it survives and that we can manage to still make a bit. What about Bristol Waste? How are they getting on? Because one of the things I've noticed, for better or for worse, since Marvin's taken over and all these cuts, is that there's a load of litter around where I am in St Paul's. Some of the streets, it's almost as if they never seem to get cleaned. And if the wind's in the wrong direction, the litter is blowing from one part of the city and it's kind of funneled into some of the cul-de-sacs. So what is going on with these Bristol Waste people?
Really can't answer that. I can, because people do actually. With one of the three main things we have in our council's mailbag is public transport, or lack of, and it is traffic congestion and Bristol Waste, because there's days they fail to turn up and people have got problems accessing the public helpline, and it does seem. When they, not so much the actual refuse collectors, but the ones that come round and pick up the green boxes and your recyclables, they seem to leave an awful lot of cardboard and paper on the streets after they've been down there. Perhaps that's being unfair, but that's the impression that's given by a lot of the complaints we receive.
Well, what I'll do is I'll have a look for that helpline, see if we can find... online, here it is. Although it doesn't actually seem to have the number. Oh, here we go. 0117-922-7223, Monday to Friday, 10 till 4. So that's... If you've got problems with the way that waste is being collected in your area, that's where you go to.
And
0117-922-2723.
And at the same time, they're very helpful in removing offensive graffiti. They'll do that within hours.
Okay.
All the nonsense graffiti, the tagging might take a bit longer, but if it's offensive or racist graffiti, they will remove it almost immediately.
Anyway, what's the latest on the Brislington Park and Ride? Because that's always... A4 is so busy almost all the time, and I'm absolutely gobsmacked. Before we came in here, you were telling me it looks as if there's going to be a load of new houses built there, which will mean even more traffic up the A4 at Brislington.
No, well, the long-term plan, and we're looking on the 25-year plan. The plan is to move the park and route out to Hicks Gate. On what's at the moment now is a garden.
That's where the gardens, Link Road is.
Yeah, where the garden. So it'd be nearer that Link Road, and houses will be built. We'd be built on the present park and ride site, and then part of the plan is with all this metro bus, but it wouldn't be called a metro bus then, is to have a rapid transport from the park and ride site along what used to be the old Somerset railway line, linking up into the Bath Road, and that would be the gas buses that Marvin and Mark Bradshaw source in it, because we got the biggest order in for biofuel gas buses for green air, so that'll improve the air quality all along that A37 Bath Road route, which will improve the air quality.
And the idea is that the buses will be able to divert past the where all the cars
are. Yeah, and it'll be a faster because it
comes out near the low decker, does it? It just as you're coming out.
No, it comes down. It comes out further down by.
The old tram works?
Yeah. No, even further down there. What used to be the old Brislington bus depot and your Sainsbury's?
Sainsbury's, I do know where you mean, the old bus depot.
Well, the old castle building, you've got the old castle pub, it comes out there, isn't it? Yeah. That used to be the old railway line, yeah.
Amazing, so that could be quite a boon. But hang on, all these houses... they're also going to create traffic, aren't they? Are you looking forward to those houses being built? I suppose that's right in your area, is it?
No.
It may just outside your...
It's outside, and it's over the opposite side of the road. It's in Brislington West. But obviously, that park and ride site is used by a lot of people because Brislington... We got the worst public transport connection in the city. People might disagree with that, but if you're fortunate enough to live up the Broomhill area, you got the service one. But if you live down through St Anne's and all that, the only bus you got is the 36, which First will acknowledge is the worst service they got. They've recently this week they've cut it in half, and this is another concern. They've cut it in half, so the 36 is only going to Brislington Square on a half hour service, like at the moment. But coming from the other end, from Withywood, is coming to Brislington, but that's only going to be
silly.
That's only going to be an hour service.
Is anyone tackling Tim Bowles, the Conservative Metro Mayor, on this?
No, they're not.
But if he was sitting where you're sitting, I would be tackling him right now, but he doesn't seem to want to come.
The people, for some reason, I don't know whether they don't know Tim Bowles exists, because a lot of people don't know if he does or what he does, but they...
Well, he turned up for the opening of the new Metro bus route, then he disappeared in a puff of purple smoke.
But apparently they're asking questions about the 36. But Marvin's got no input on the buses at all. He can suggest, like he did with the fare. And in fairness to Marvin, if you were one of these and you got one of these prepaid cards, or you can do it on your phone, the day rider as you, or whatever it is still only £4. It's only £4.50 if you're actually paying him cash. But every other method, even if you pay on your card, it is £4.
Well, I don't advise anyone to use the app on their phone because if you look at as you download the app, it wants to know everything about you and it wants to know all of the files. It wants to be able to have all the files and all your contact details on your phone and everything, like literally everything. So I took one look at that and thought, there's no way that thing's going on my phone. Just simply for privacy reasons. And I'd like to know from First why they think they need all that information before they can so-called sell me a bus ticket. You can actually apparently buy them in shops, I think.
Yeah.
So you don't have to use the app.
No.
But that's pretty cheeky of them, really, to be honest with you.
Well, I can't answer that because I'm one of those. I'm of that age. I got a phone. I haven't got an old singing or dancing phone. I got a phone that just lets me make phone calls.
So is it one of those ones you have to pick up the thing and stick it in your ear?
No.
All right,
it's
Mike.
Shaped like a brick. No, it's not. It's just the phone. I got a camera on it though, because I'm getting her.
Mark, one thing has been a bit of a bone of contention over the last while. We've got what might be quite an exciting full council meeting coming up next week, if you can call them exciting, because they'll be talking about the bear pit and whether the bear is going to go or not, because there's been a public petition that they have to talk about that. But the last one, they're generally on a Tuesday, and the last one was in middle of December, where the Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees, and he won't come on, he's like Tim Bowles, doesn't want to come on this radio programme, which is a pity. We'd love to have them. It's not as if I bite or anything, but I might ask a few awkward questions, that's true. I'm not going to just give them an easy, super easy ride. And one of the things that Marvin was talking about back in December at the full council meeting was the £100,000 that was paid to the senior chief executive, Anna Klonowski, of our money. And there's been no real explanation why this money was paid. He didn't need to pay it. And what it seems that Marvin is doing is he's now criticising the very auditors that pointed out that this money shouldn't have been paid, even though Private Eye, I think, had a little role in pointing it out. But let's see what Marvin Rees, the Labour Mayor's reaction was when he was criticised for this £100,000 payment to Anna Klonowski, which didn't need to be paid. And I'll get your comments afterwards, Mike.
The decision we made was in accordance with the legal advice, both the legal and the HR advice, given at the time, and we stand with that. I've shared too about questions of the auditors in their final year of working for Bristol City Council. I do have questions about where they were when we inherited a £30 million black hole in the budget and then suddenly got very forensic afterwards, but that's another question that's worth pursuing as well. But we just acted in line with the legal and HR advice.
What do you make of this £100,000 payment, Mike? What do you think it was made? That's a lot of money, isn't it?
It is a lot of money, but then she
was... our money.
She was, yeah, but she was on a lot of money, but apparently chief execs do get over 90 grand to 100,000, which which is excessive to the majority of us. But I, like other councillors, were led to believe, told, and that she took this money so to sort of pay up her contract.
But she was, I mean, apparently they didn't have to give her the money. It was a sort of goodwill payment.
Well,
Big goodwill
payment. Yeah. This has come out since, but at the time we'd had the fight from HR, from the HR and the auditors and all the rest of it.
The other thing is the auditors that have criticised this and now being sacked. Now, that sounds a little bit like shooting the messenger. The auditors have come along and said, well, hang on a minute, where's this? What's happening with this £100,000 here? Marvin is saying, well, actually, I'll tell you what, we don't want you guys as auditors of the City Council anymore. But they're just doing their job, aren't they?
Yeah. I believe they're still ongoing, and I believe scrutiny's still looking into it. So hopefully that question will get resolved one way or the other.
Well, let's certainly hope so. One of our MPs was at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday. We very rarely hear Bristol MPs. And the only one, I think, over the last year or so has been Jack Napresti. And I do actually listen to them religiously every week. And you do get some very good questions at Prime Minister's Questions, unlike Question Time, which now seems to be going downhill fast at the BBC with Fiona Bruce. But let's have a listen now to Jack Napresti, who's rather cheering about the end of tolls on the Severn Bridge.
Jack Napresti.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I thank my right honourable friend for ensuring our manifesto commitment to scrapping tolls on the Severn Bridge crossing has been met? This will put £1,400 a year into the pockets of thousands of motorists, many of which are my constituents, and does she agree this will help transform the economies of the South West and South Wales?
Can I say to my honourable friend, I think this is an important step that the government has taken. It is one that was advocated, I know, by individual members and by the Secretary of State for Wales, and it will indeed, I believe, have a very positive economic effect, a positive economic effect on Wales, but also a positive economic effect on the South West and indeed on constituencies like my honourable friends.
Apparently, I don't know how Question Time works, but apparently it's a lottery, and so there's only... so. Presumably, she's chosen Jack Napresti.
So why aren't we hearing from Karen Smith? Why aren't we hearing from Kerry McCarthy? Why aren't we hearing from Darren Jones?
I can't speak for...
Come on, folks. Let's have some questions.
I can't speak for Darren, Karen, or...
Kerry?
No. Kerry's my MP. Kerry has been selected, and she does ask a lot of questions, and even in other times. But it is a lot who gets chosen.
Anyway, so another question that came up. Well, it's nice to hear no more tolls. Time to go to Newport for holidays, maybe. Even though it's not the greatest place, maybe, for a holiday. But you know, I think maybe some of us from Bristol will be going over there a little bit more if we've got cars. So another something from Prime Minister's Questions before we hit Brexit, before the 7 o'clock news, and we talk about Brexit. There was a FASA, brilliant question. This is the sort of thing I'd like to see Kerry, Darren and Karen asking questions about here in Bristol, because we've got something like 10% of all the street homeless deaths last year, which were reported just before Christmas. And this was brought up by a York MP on Wednesday.
Rachel Maskell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. York has been in shock as we have learnt that 11 homeless people in our city died last year. And whilst we know this is an issue across the nation, we know substance misuse services have been cut. We know the social housing hasn't been built in our city. And we know that mental health services are desperately underfunded and understaffed. Prime Minister, I don't want to hear what you have done, because clearly it has failed. I want to know what you're going to do differently so no homeless person dies this year.
Prime Minister!
every death of someone, well, hopeless, homeless or sleeping rough on our streets is one too many. And that's why, you know, we have the commitment in relation to rough sleeping to ending it by 2027 and halving it by 2022. We've committed, she says she doesn't want to know what we've done, but we have committed over £1.2 billion to tackle homelessness and rough sleeping. And she mentions mental health service and asks, what are we going to do in the future? What we're doing in the future is putting an extra £2.3 billion into mental health services to ensure that we're providing those mental health services for those people who sadly currently are not able to access them.
I feel the government have deliberately underfunded National Health Service. You only got to look at the waiting times, and even for simple operation, cancer patients and all the rest of it. I myself recently got nothing but praise for the NHS. I had a cancerous mole removed from my back about 6 weeks ago. I just went in the game Monday this week and I had a bit more chopped out. Hopefully they're finished when they get all the way through. But the care, but you can see the cutbacks.
The other thing, of course, is you've got the increasing influence of the United States on this country as we move out of the EU, if we do. And that means, of course, these American private healthcare companies want the NHS out of the way. I would also say something about my health this week, is that I've had a bad shoulder for nearly a year, on and off, after I had a vaccination. It's probably nothing to do with it. But that shoulder, I went to see the chiropractor on Monday. I've got no help with chiropractic through the National Health Service, and it's already starting to get better. It's amazing, incredible. So if you've got muscle, bone problems, I would always suggest going to see a chiropractor as well. Another, we must also talk about Brexit before we finish. And one of the things brought up at this week's Prime Minister's Questions is the question, are we actually going to leave? Actually, before we hear from the MP at Prime Minister's Questions, what's your guess? Is it going to be no deal, no Brexit, or is Theresa May going to get her deal, or is it going to be something else?
It's going to be no deal, and I think it shows the desperation of her when she has ignored trade unions, workers' rights, and apparently she was phoning Len McCluskey. I'd have loved to have been in the room when they said, Len, Theresa May's on the phone to you, come on, eh? It would have been magic to sit in that. I mean, workers' rights, what a scrap. Lim Fox said it was a chance to tear up all regulations and red tape. What he meant was our workers' rights and conditions that we've struggled for. The European Social Charter. Maggie Thatcher said...
I mean, surely if we do that, it's almost going to be a shoe-in for Corbyn afterwards. But anyway, let's have a listen now to this week's Prime Minister's Questions. Are we actually going to leave?
Dr. Julian Lewis, according to that invaluable website, theyworkforyou.com, the Prime Minister has assured this House on no fewer than 74 previous occasions that we will be leaving the EU on the 29th of March. Will she categorically confirm today that there's absolutely no question at all of delaying that date?
Prime Minister!
I'm happy to repeat what I have said previously, that we will be leaving the European Union on the 29th of March. I want us to leave the European Union on the 29th of March with a good deal that's on the table.
Now, Yvette Cooper this week put a bit of a spanner in the works, didn't she? And she got 20 Conservatives to back her, saying that there must be no changes to the finance bill which would help a no deal.
It is for many in Parliament a worst-case scenario, but one that grows more possible by the day.
The other objection that people have said is that it is unnecessary because the Prime Minister's deal is the one they want as the way forward. I just disagree, but I think the reality is not my view, but the view in the House. There is not at this stage support for the Prime Minister's deal, and I do not think there would be. We have to be able to respond to what happens next. And I finally heard some say they want the imminent threat of no deal to persuade people to back the Prime Minister's deal, if not now, but then later on. But brinkmanship in Parliament is not the way to resolve this and get the best deal for the country. And this is too serious for us to play a massive Brexit game of chicken. The country cannot afford to wait to see who blinks first.
Hardly surprising, then, that those opposed to a no-deal Brexit are doing all they can to prevent it.
I believe the government should rule out no deal, but I think if it won't, then Parliament must make sure that it has the powers to do so if it comes to the crunch.
It is time for members of Parliament on all sides start ruling out deeply damaging options to our country.
Voting by a majority in favour of a measure that blocks public spending on a no-deal outcome, MPs on both sides demonstrated their opposition to the government's current course.
So it's almost as if you've got Parliament now is trying to make sure that this Brexit doesn't happen, Mike. Is that right, do you think?
Yes. I vote with Remain. And Margaret Thatcher, I always keep going back to that evil woman, but Margaret Thatcher said the European Union was socialism by the back door. And I thought, if Thatcher hates it, it's got to be all right for me. And even the DUP that she's bribed with billions, with what you think that could have done with the NHS and all the rest of it, I can't see them accepting her Northern Ireland backstop, or whatever you like to call it. Because I got interest because I had an Irish mother and Irish grandparents. And for me and for a lot of people in Ireland and Southern Ireland, where my family roots are, there was only one border in Ireland, and that is the Irish Sea.
Well, maybe that's the way it will be. Looks like it might well be.
Well, hopefully.
Now, and that's a peculiar story. This is in the National Press this week. A pensioner was jailed for accusing a school parent of killing and eating babies. Well, apparently you can do that sort of thing, but if you start to name names of people and teachers you think have been involved, a pensioner accused innocent parents of killing babies and eating them as part of a satanic ritual has been jailed for 9 years this week. Sabine McNeil, she's 74 years old, led a campaign to uncover claims of devil worship and child abuse at a primary school in Hampstead, northwest London. Well, she ran a website called Victims Unite, and I've had her years ago as a guest on talking about what appear to be legitimate claims, not of satanic ritual abuse, but of child stealing by the state. So she's been a campaigner for many years, and I spoke to someone who was in court this week to see this case, to get his point of view. His name is Maurice Kirk.
This is a lady who was part of one of the original designers of internet and cyberspace and emails. At the age of 21, she was working in Switzerland at the CERN laboratories, and she has been a dedicated mathematician and politician and helps in family courts. And she has set up talks with members of parliament in the House of Commons about issues that are of concern to all of us. And today I witnessed the worst I could imagine. A lady older than me, she was in a pram being pushed out of the Dresden while we were dropping a thousand bombers in February 45, and she was 6 months old. And she was being pushed just ahead of the firestorm that killed everybody, because if you drop enough bombs in a single place, they take up all the oxygen and the people in the city don't get burnt, they suffocate. And that's where she started. And today she's been made an example of. But the bit that needs to be told is that she's never had a parking fine in her life. She's never broken a law. She has no allegations against her for breaching any minor or major laws. But she got surrounded. Now, you have met Sabine, and I have watched her working, absolutely dedicated at helping people. And this time, she got surrounded by people on their own agenda. I'm sorry to say, they were not all women, but they were 75% were nutters. And they persuaded her to believe stories about rituals, child abuse, and more nasty things than that, which we won't mention, but you can guess. They will be in the paper tomorrow. She trusts everybody, and she has been hit very hard today. And I'm very worried, because she's not a well person. She's 74. She was, in fact, technically given a 12-year prison term. And the judge said, owing to her age, it was 9. It was for technically stalking, because she was pursuing particular people who she'd been told were involved with these rituals, child rituals, and breaching restraining orders. She was seriously influenced by these well-educated women who have now run away, of course. I mean, this is life, isn't it? I mean, I've helped people on drugs. When I was in prison, I was doing people's court cases. And you could see that young kids were being dragged into a syndicate where they took the blame, but the ringleaders got away with it. And this is what's happened with Sabine. I'm very concerned. But she believed and trusted the people who put her up to it. And they won't get touched.
So that's Maurice Kirk there, and I'll put the full version of that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Bit of a weird one, but 9 years in prison for a 74-year-old for what she thought was pursuing what the police weren't doing. I mean, basically her allegation was that the police hadn't done a proper investigation into this case and that there was some kind of child abuse, and it's pretty clear that there wasn't. That's a long time to spend in jail for a 74-year-old, Mike.
It is, yeah, but if somebody had told you 10, 15 years ago that they'd be discover up to 200 babies' bones in an Irish Catholic orphanage from the Sisters of Mad, you wouldn't have believed that sort of thing. But that things have been uncovered, isn't it? So it's not beyond the realms of possibility, is it? I mean, who would have thought the scandals that coming out of Ireland would...
And of course the Jimmy Savile case as well. Anyway,
well,
look,
time for
the Comcast US owned news at 7 o'clock. Now thanks to our guest Labour councillor for Brislington East, Mike Langley. Join us after the US owned Comcast news at 7 as we spread our wings around the world.
BCFM is an award winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour live from the Sky News Centre.